I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. Today, Mayor Sly James talks about the latest proposal to remake KCI into a single terminal airport. We'll get his thoughts on a privately financed plan to upgrade Kansas City's international gateway. Then, the U.S. and its allies have been fighting the war on terror for more than 15 years. Everything from drones to bombs to boots on the ground are used to fight violent extremism around the world. But in an unorthodox war, what if the solution is equally unconventional? Today, how entrepreneurship might address terrorism and maybe even curtail it. After that, Bill Brownlee and the latest Local Listen. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. The U.S. and its allies around the globe have fought for years to stop violent extremism. Throughout Asia, Africa, the Middle East, and elsewhere, hundreds of thousands of lives have been lost, billions of dollars have been spent, and the results, well, Monday night's bombing in Manchester, England, is a grim reminder that the results have been rather disappointing. My first guest says that's because we failed to deal with the underlying cause of extremism. Stephen Coltai is a guest scholar at Brookings Institution. He runs a consultancy that fosters entrepreneurship overseas. All this after a successful career in business and entertainment, and as a stint as a senior advisor for entrepreneurship under then Secretary of State Hillary Clinton. And Stephen, welcome. So nice to have you here.
Thanks. It's great to be here.
And welcome home, by the way.
Thank you.
Yeah. So enlighten us here. What's the underlying cause of extremism that's gone so unaddressed for all of these years?
Well, my basic research shows that the single biggest cause of political violence is joblessness, specifically among young people, and the desperation that that joblessness leads to.
They lose hope, and then that triggers other behaviors we don't want to see.
That's exactly right. And by the way, this has been true for a long time in a lot of places. It's not just in the Arab world. It's not just Muslims. It's also been true in America's inner cities. In 1932, 27% of Germans under the age of 28 were unemployed. Hmm. So this has been true throughout history.
I wonder how much we can attribute the results of the last election to dissatisfaction among American voters who can't find jobs that give them any security.
Well, that's exactly the point. Jobs in most places, domestic, foreign, wherever, usually are the number one political issue. You can imagine, though, when we have an 8% or a 6% unemployment rate, everybody is completely apoplectic. In the Arab world, it's 40% on average.
Wow.
And that's only men because they don't even count women in most countries.
40%.
40% youth unemployment rate.
Your theory is not focused on just any job, Stephen. You're talking specifically about entrepreneurship, small homegrown businesses. I'm wondering why.
Well, so I make the point in my book that it is no-tech, low-tech, and high-tech jobs that really scale. And I make a distinction between small business and entrepreneurial businesses. To me, an entrepreneur is somebody who innovates a product or process. So, for example, Starbucks didn't invent coffee, but they changed the way that coffee was sold. More people work for Starbucks in the greater San Francisco Bay Area than for Google worldwide.
I didn't know that.
So it's a kind of a fun fact. It's a non-tech business. We, you know, in the States, we always think of entrepreneurship as tech. Mm-hmm. In the developing world where I work, it's as often non-tech and it's as often process innovation as product innovation.
But still, entrepreneurship is a component of this.
Oh, it's the central. It's the definition. For me, the definition of entrepreneurship is innovation, which distinguishes it, for example, from any small business. So if somebody opens a hair salon, that's a small business. If somebody starts Supercuts, which changes the logic of how it works, that's an entrepreneurial business.
And you want to push entrepreneurial because
it creates a lot more jobs.
Okay. It sparks stuff.
Right. So Supercuts and Starbucks, as an example, create many times more jobs than just opening a new beauty shop does.
And do you think entrepreneurship then can create enough jobs that it actually begins to affect worldwide peace?
Well, so, you know, in the United States, and Kansas City is the epicenter of this because the Kauffman Foundation is based here. It's the largest funder of entrepreneurship research on the planet. So it's not just in the U.S. The fact of the matter is that entrepreneurs are the biggest job creators. And we know this as Americans historically. Mm-hmm. From 1985 to 2005, all of the net job growth in the United States, according to Kauffman, was in startups and small businesses. There was a net decrease in Fortune 500 payrolls.
And you make the link between entrepreneurship and peace. How?
Well, the research that I've done shows that of all of the causes of conflict, and this is over, you know, 500 years, there's sectarian violence, there's a battle over geography, there's a battle over resources, but the one constant is economics. Mm. Economics is the single biggest driver, and within economics, it's joblessness. And so the desperation that comes, you know, in Cairo, if you're a 24-year-old guy, you will probably never in your life have a job. Hmm. So what does that do to you? You will never be able to support a family. You will never be able to buy a home. What does that do to you in your sense of values? And so my argument is that because the evidence is so strong of the correlation between violence and joblessness, we ought to be doing more. You know, entrepreneurship is in our DNA.
Well, this seems to make so much sense to me. So why don't we hear more about it?
Well, there are a lot of reasons. One is because it's unpopular to talk about creating jobs abroad when we always need more jobs at home. Okay, so that's, you know,
it's a political issue.
It's a political issue. The second is that there is a sense that you know everything has to be just so in order for entrepreneurship to exist. And it is certainly true that the enabling environment, the regulatory environment, for example, in the work I do in developing countries, the single biggest impediment to entrepreneurship is corruption. And so as Americans, we shy away and we say, you know, you don't have your act together. It's way too dangerous and we're not going to get involved in this. And my argument is that if you look at a place like Iraq or Afghanistan, where we have spent the low end is over $2 trillion since the beginning of hostilities, over 25,000 American lives, millions of refugees. To the best of our knowledge, the youth unemployment rate in those two countries is about 125% of what it was before we started.
And the other issue that we've talked about on this show with the Kauffman people, of course, it goes hand in hand with entrepreneurship, is this idea that a lot of entrepreneurs ultimately fail.
Well, absolutely. A lot of entrepreneurs ultimately fail. But I would argue that the $2 trillion that we've spent in Iraq and Afghanistan have also failed. And I would argue that post 9/11, and certainly what we just saw in Manchester in the last 36 hours is an example of that, that we are not necessarily, we haven't necessarily had a good ROI on the investment that we have made, you know, whether it's the military hardware that we've bought, the drone attacks. I'm not sure that given the fact that the youth unemployment rate is 125% of what it was, that the minute that we withdraw, it doesn't all come unglued again. And isn't it time to think about at least a little bit? I'm not saying we abandon military effort, but I'm just saying as a side, couldn't we use what built America to also make America safer?
Are we doing any of that right now? Any portion of these billions of dollars we're spending going to entrepreneurship?
1%, just under 1% of the USAID budget, which is less than 1% of the federal budget, so it's 1% of 1%, is spent in this area. The U.S. is about the 7th or 8th largest funder behind such giants as Norway, the Netherlands, and Sweden. The U.S. spends roughly the same amount of money as Australia, which has 25 million people, is an island surrounded by water on all sides, 15 hours from anywhere, and has 1/25th our GNP.
But we have a businessman as president now. Perhaps the table is more clearly set than it has been?
Well, that's an excellent point. And in fact, I've just written a piece called Entrepreneur in Chief. And I'm hoping, because there's no question that regardless of what anybody thinks about Donald Trump, he himself would characterize himself first and foremost as an entrepreneur. So he certainly understands the importance and power of this. And I'm hoping that in the current administration, there might be a change.
I'm speaking with Stephen Coltaw. He's a guest scholar at the Brookings Institution and will be speaking tonight at the Kansas City Public Library's Plaza Branch about his new book. It's called Peace Through Entrepreneurship. For more information, go to kclibrary.org. I'm wondering, there are these entrepreneurship delegations that you're involved with. What does that do? What do they look like? And how does it aim to achieve and define success here?
Well, that is an example of one of about three dozen programs that I run to promote entrepreneurship abroad. I've done eight of them, seven while I was at the State Department. They're 12 to 15 American early stage investors and cashed out entrepreneurs. They go to a certain economy. We've been to eight countries: Egypt, Indonesia, Turkey, Lebanon, Jordan, Algeria, Tunisia, Morocco. There are a number of things. It's a business plan competition, so you're listening to pitches. Everyone who goes on these has to be open to making an angel-level investment, which means $25,000 to $50,000. They don't have to make one if they don't find a company they like, but they have to be open to it.
That startup capital is always a huge issue.
Huge issue. And one of the things I find and that we do in these missions is we try and spur local angel investors. So for the 12 or 15 Americans that go, I also have 12 or 15 local wealthy individuals who could invest in their own startups if they ever thought that they were worth it. And what I find is when you bring the Americans over and they find a gem, then all of a sudden the local people say, hey, wait a minute, this was in my backyard and I missed this. And then they also tend to invest. So they have multiple purposes, not just raising money for the companies that are pitching, but also spurring the angel investor environment.
You know, at some point, Stephen, the delegation leaves, and then it's up to the local government to sustain this entrepreneurship ecosystem that you write about. What happens then?
Well, it's first of all, it's not just the local government, it's the local economy. So I have this theory of the 6+6 model for entrepreneurship ecosystem building. Six categories of activity: identify, train, connect, and sustain, fund, enable public policy, and celebrate entrepreneurs. And six categories of players: corporations, foundations, universities, non-government organizations, academia, and government. So it is not just one player or just one activity. If you look, for example, at Kansas City and at the entrepreneurship flowering that's been happening here, you can't point to just one thing that made that happen. There were a lot of forces that came together, certainly including the universities, including foundations, and particularly including the business community. Mm-hmm. So the same thing is true abroad. One of the things I always try to emphasize is that this is, you know, you can do well by doing good. You know, the greatest wealth in America has been created by entrepreneurs. For example, Ewing, Marion Kaufman. The greatest financial return to investors has been those investors who have invested in entrepreneurs, right? The people who invested in Apple in the beginning. So my argument is that because the growth rate in developing countries is so much greater than it is in the U.S. or will be in any developed country, we Americans are missing an opportunity if we're not participating. So, you know, it's a very important way to not only help people abroad, but frankly, also help ourselves.
What do U.S. senators say when you talk to them about this?
Well, it's, you know, all over the lot. It's a mixed bag. There are members of Congress who do understand and support this, particularly, frankly, those who have a business background and have themselves been entrepreneurs. On the other hand, you know, there's a huge constituency favoring DOD military spending. So the $100 billion deal that we just did in Saudi Arabia, that everybody can relate to that. Everybody knows who Lockheed Martin is, who Northrop Grumman is. When you talk about entrepreneurship, it's a much more diffused constituency. So none of the members of Congress necessarily have the same pressure to push entrepreneurship in the service of foreign policy.
I'm wondering about the brain drain here. You know, a lot of entrepreneurs get their feet under them at home and then, you know, they'll move to California to really get going. Does that work against the work done overseas in a similar way?
Well, yes, it is true that, I mean, for example, the entrepreneur who won the business plan competition that I took a delegation to Egypt for, which was the first country I went to, which about a month before Tahrir Square, is now based in San Francisco. But having said that, the fact of the matter is that he is still employing 50 people in Alexandria, Egypt, even though his office is in Silicon Valley.
Mm-hmm. Have you seen any one entrepreneur come close to having the kind of enormous success of a Starbucks or Apple or anything like that?
Oh, absolutely. One of the examples I talk about, another delegation I did was to Indonesia. 7 years ago, there was a company called Gojek, G-O-J-E-K, who was pitching. They were trying to raise $250,000 of seed capital for what is basically a scooter-based Uber. Jakarta, like every developing country capital, has impenetrable traffic. You can't get anywhere. So he used scooters with text messages both to deliver people and stuff. Huh. They raised the $250,000. Three people in our delegation put money in, $25,000 or $50,000. A year ago, a Chinese investor, the equivalent of Uber, invested $560 million, valuing the company at $1.2 billion.
So it works sometimes.
It works.
You know, you write this too, Stephen. During my stint with the State Department, I witnessed all the oxymoronic inefficiencies of a bureaucracy doing entrepreneurship. How does the government manage to step on its own toes when it comes to doing this work? What happens?
Well, it's a long story, but the bottom line is that one of the greatest frustrations I had was that there were 60 offices doing entrepreneurship scattered in 12 different departments in the U.S. government. My program, the Global Entrepreneurship Program at the State Department, was just one. Of all of those people, there was not a single person I ever met who themselves had ever been an entrepreneur. So one of the problems is that here we have America, which is the entrepreneurial paradigm of the world, but there's actually no one from the entrepreneurial sector in America working in the government. And one of the ideas that I have is kind of a Peace Corps for entrepreneurs, where we take American entrepreneurs, very often who are cashed out and want to give back and want to do something. I, for example, run a mentoring program where you can be a Skype mentor remotely. I'm doing it now in sub-Saharan Africa with 20 companies. Okay. So there's so much we could do if we only drew on the resources that we already have here. Those are not, generally speaking, present in the government today.
You know, why does the government have to be involved in all this to begin with? I mean, why can't we just leave this job to foundations like Kauffman across the street or consultancies like your own or private businesses, you know, at all?
Scale.
Too much to be done.
It's too much to be done. And the other thing is, and I in my book, I have some case studies starting with the U.S. and Israel, but also including Rwanda, for example. There are no example of successful entrepreneurial ecosystems anywhere in the world, including regionally in the U.S., including in Kansas City, that did not have government intimately involved in helping to spur it. Not necessarily forever, but certainly as the catalyst and creating an environment, whether it's zoning laws for building a business incubator, or whether it's tax laws for angel investors to invest, or whether it's intellectual property protection to protect your copyright or trademark.
Yeah.
Those are all things that only government can do.
Stephen Coltai, again, is my guest. You can see and hear him this evening talk more about entrepreneurship at the Kansas City Public Library, the Plaza Branch, not far from our studios here. Go to kclibrary.org for more information. Again, his book is titled Peace Through Entrepreneurship. What an interesting conversation. Stephen, I appreciate it very much.
Thanks much.
Time for a break. When we come back, the mayor of Kansas City will be here to talk about the airport. What else? I'm Steve Kraske, and you're listening to Up to Date on 89.3 KCUR. Yes, we have returned up to date. I'm Steve Kraske. Yesterday, we spoke with jazz guitarist John Scofield, who will perform at the KC Jazz and Heritage Festival this weekend. And we learned why America's role in World War I remains very much alive for the French. You can find those conversations at kcur.org/up-to-date. On tomorrow's program, why basic issues divide Americans from other Western countries and from each other. Also, the president of the Actors Equity talks about the future of the arts and being on the road in the musical Fun Home. That's tomorrow on the show. Well, Kansas City Mayor Sly James is in the house to take our questions about that much-talked-about proposal from Burns and McDonald to build that new single terminal up at Kansas City International Airport. The mayor is a big proponent of this privately financed plan. Some members of the city council have questions and even reservations. Last week, we talked to a couple of council members and a representative of Burns and Mac about some basic tenets of this idea. You can find that conversation online at kcur.org/up-to-date. And just a reminder, I'm a member of the STARS editorial board, and the board supports a new single terminal at the airport, but has questions about this plan. And Mayor, it's always great to have you. Welcome back.
Thank you, Steve.
You like this idea for a privately financed terminal that Burns and McDonald has put forward. Why? Explain to us what you're thinking here.
Well, there's only been about three options. First of all, let me go back and lay some history.
Yeah.
2012, then airport director Van Lowe said we needed a new single terminal, and controversy ensued. 2013, I appointed a 24-member citizens task force, 19 of whom after a year then recommended that a new single terminal be built. Controversy ensued. Then the airlines and the airport started working on an agreement for leasing, and they wanted to take a look at it because they were kind of driving that bus a little bit. They looked at over 50 iterations, thought that they could do a major renovation, decided that they could not, came out with their report in April of 2016, wherein they basically said, we want to expand in Kansas City. We need to expand in Kansas City. Our planes are getting bigger. The current configuration does not work for us and cannot be renovated. It is inefficient. We will pay $964 million for a new terminal. Controversy ensued. I took it off the calendar a little bit later. Controversy ensued, but in a different way. Then people started yelling, why did you do that? I asked the business community to step up and take some leadership, and they've done that. But in the interim, here's what's happened. We have been approached by a couple of infrastructure banks from overseas who have offered to finance the deal, but they want a percentage of the airport ownership, and they want to operate it. Those are non-starters here, okay?
Because?
Well, for a couple of reasons. Number one, we don't believe that we want to sell off an asset like that. Other cities that have sold assets have regretted it. Indianapolis sold their water department, later had to buy it back for more than they sold it for. Mm. All sorts of issues come up when you sell assets. Plus, this is a labor-oriented deal in a lot of ways, and the first thing that happens is the labor gets cut, salaries get cut, benefits get cut, profits go up for the people who own it. It's a non-starter.
Okay.
We tried that with 18 members of the fire department, you might recall, just on collecting bills. All hell broke out.
Yeah.
Okay, so that's a non-starter.
Right.
Okay, so then nobody else stepped up to do anything except Burns and Mac, and they stepped up in late March and said, we've got an idea. We're still working on the numbers. We'd like to run this idea to ground. We need some time. Besides, you've already said we don't want any talk about this while we're waiting and working on GO Bond. So we'll wait until after GO Bond passes and see what we can do.
That was the vote in April on sewers and streets and all those things.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So they came up with a deal that works for this city and works extremely well. And I'll tell you why. Under the original proposal, where the airlines agreed that they would pay $964 million for an airport, here's how that works. They would pay the money for the airport out of receipts of concessions and parking and things like that. And if there was a shortfall, they'd make up the difference. They would take between 30 and 35 years to pay that debt back at $85.2 million a year for that time frame. We would then have to do the contracting work, et cetera, and it would be finished about 2026. All right. Under this new proposal, Oh, I'm sorry. The city would have to buy, sell bonds, mm-hmm. and the value of those bonds would go on the city's budget as a debt. Okay?
Okay.
So, under the new proposal, Burns and Mack says we believe that we can engineer this to an $85.2 million 30 to 35 year payback problem. We can build this in a year and a half less time, which will save money on the back end, make up the difference between private. You don't have to sell any bonds. You don't have to carry any debt. And it's all hometown work.
You know, is one issue here, Mayor, that, you know, this is a bite of the apple in terms of people's ability to wrap their collective arms around this thing and understand it. And this seems to be happening quickly. Is that an issue?
You mean happening quickly since 2012?
Well, no, since the Burns and Mack thing came forward.
Well, you know, I think people are making this a lot more complicated than it really needs to be, because they're doing essentially what the airlines agreed to do, essentially for the same payback amount that the airlines agreed to pay for it. And they're taking the city and taxpayers completely out of harm's way. The city is not responsible for any cost overruns. Burns and Mack would be. There's another part to this. There is a business need and a civic need for this terminal. Mm-hmm. We can't ignore that. That's been an issue for a long time. And I know people who travel 3-4 times a year love the convenience, and nobody's going to build an airport that's not convenient. Just the contrary. Mm-hmm. We're going to build an airport that in a lot of ways will be even more convenient. Mm-hmm. Whereas now we have 6,000 parking spaces scattered between three terminals. In the new terminal, it would be 6,500 parking spaces right at the front door. No issues there. People talk about the walking distance. Walking distance will be equivalent or the same. Not a big deal. If you have to go over to the other side of the T, you're a movable sidewalk. So you don't even have to walk. You just have to stand there and look pretty. Okay? And then you get there and you do the same thing. This isn't new. This is just simply a different way of paying for what we've been talking about for 5 years. And the way it's being paid for really works to the benefit of the city and to the taxpayers.
If Burns and Mack has put forward this really great proposal, one thing you've heard a whole lot about, Mayor, is why not slow down and see if the other very fine engineering firms in this town can come up with a proposal that's just as good or maybe even better?
Well, the engineering firms in this town had a year to come up with a proposal. They did not.
But there was not a formal request for proposals at that time, though.
And there wasn't a formal request for proposals with Burns and Mack either. But here's the other thing about it. We don't have time to wait. This has been going on a long time. The airlines are getting impatient, okay? This is something they've said a long time ago. We need this to happen. We have a business need to expand. Their bigger airlines or planes are coming online. The current configuration at the terminals do not accommodate those planes. They have problems with passengers. They will not bring passengers into this airport in order to transfer them because the experience is so bad. And I know people who walk out off the street into the airport and then directly to their plane don't understand that. But there's a lot of people who spend a lot of time in that airport, and it is not convenient in the least. So we have to get this moving. You know, we have one real good option, and that's to do it in November. Mm-hmm. And the next poorer option is in April.
The editorial board has been told there have been other companies in town that have expressed interest in the wake of all this. Are you aware of that? I mean, have they come to you and said, Mayor,
no,
we want to take a shot at this
no.
thing? Nobody?
No.
Nobody.
Nobody has come to my office and said, Mayor, we've got an idea to do this. Nobody called us up to say, let's go to lunch and talk about this. I checked with Troy Schulte. He didn't either. The only ones that we've ever heard from are infrastructure banks who wanted to do this and own a piece of the property, control the airport itself, and those were non-starters.
Is there
but nobody has sat in my office and explained anything, asked anything, made a phone call to me. The answer is no.
Is there a chance these companies think it's already a done deal, it's already set for Burns and Mack?
Well, where were they before Burns and Mack? That's the question.
There wasn't a formal request for proposals that the city had put out to these companies seeking those proposals.
That didn't stop Burns and Mack from coming up with an idea. Well, they could have done the same thing.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, nobody stopped anybody from coming up to us and saying, I've got an idea how to do this. Mm-hmm. There wasn't some big sign that says no ideas accepted.
Right.
So they had the same chance that somebody else did, and Burns and Mack came up with an idea that works. Now, I want to make something clear. The This isn't a competition of trying to squeeze out one party or another. That's not what this is about. This is about doing something that is in the absolute best interest of this city. We had a local company step up and say, we've got an idea. We pursued that idea. We put forth an MOU that outlines the processes to go forward. And if it's not adopted, it's not adopted. And then this thing doesn't pass. And then we're stuck around looking at this for another 10 years because it won't come up again during my tenure. So this is not a new subject. This has been going on for 5 years. And it's not been done. So this is a proposal that works well for the city, has no risk to the taxpayers. It's done by a company that has 3 years of number three in the country in airport building and things of that nature. They're willing to do it and backstop it with the money and take the risk. And there's some benefit to them, no doubt. They do airports around the world.
And there's
what happens when people who want to do business with them come in and want to do business with them to our airport and wonder why our airport is not any better shape than it is. So they build a card, a business card for other business.
And there's a guarantee, a minimum amount guarantee of what they would spend to get this thing done?
Maximum amount.
Yeah, I'm wondering, is a maximum amount, and is there? They will also say we'll spend at least this much money to get this thing built?
They're trying to fit it within the same numbers as the airlines at $964 million. That's now 2 years old.
Right.
It is extremely impossible, I would think, for them to match that number
given
penny
construction
for penny
inflation.
Because things have gone up. That's what happens when you wait.
Mayor Sly James is in the house. We're talking about Kansas City International Airport, the proposal from Burns and McDonald to build a new single terminal up there. They'll privately finance it. Our phone number here, 816-235-2888, or you can tweet us at KCUR up to date. Let's go to Charlie from Kansas City, Missouri. Charlie, good morning.
Hello.
Hi.
Thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Just briefly, I'm a contractor in Kansas City, Missouri, and have been for over 35 years. And I just want to throw in a plug and a reassurance for the approach that Burns and McDonald has used. The idea of doing design-build is not at all new and very common in the industry. And what I tell my clients when they don't know about what that is and feel a little uneasy is, I want you to vet me, know that you are, trust me as a company first. If you do that, then we're working together, not across the table, and you will have the opportunity all along the way to approve of and be involved in where we go from here, both on cost and design. But now we're working as partners, and that does not have to mean it's going to have negatives to it if you trust who you're with and you have checked them out and their track record. That's my point.
Okay. Charlie, any comments, Mayor?
He's right on the point.
Yeah.
That's exactly the way that we're trying to proceed.
Okay. Mike from Shawnee. Mike, you're on with the Mayor. Good morning.
Hey, thanks, Steve. Hi, Mr. Mayor. I tell you, I don't live in Kansas City, Missouri, but I fly out of that airport 80 or 90 days a year. And it's the user fee is the way to do it. I mean, I don't understand why you just don't go ahead and do this. This looks like a great deal. And if the few people that complain about it, I'll tell you in my life, everybody who's said, well, I don't know about this, I ask them, how many times do you fly out of that airport? Oh, I haven't for 4 years.
Right.
You know, don't build it for them. Build it for the rest of us.
You know, thank you, Mike. I appreciate that. You know, in theory, Mayor, you could go ahead and build this thing, but you made a promise a few years ago. Tell us about that.
Well, the city council, well, first of all, part of the promise was a recognition that there was going to be a vote anyhow. When you sell bonds, you got to have a vote.
Mm-hmm.
And so we promised people that they would have that vote. Now that we don't have to sell bonds under this scenario, which is good for the city. We're still going to let them have the vote because that's what we said. We're not going to break that promise. This is a critical decision.
What would the vote decide?
Whether or not to go forward.
Just yes or no, up or down on
pretty much,
is this the way to go?
Pretty much. I'm not sure exactly how to be worded, but pretty much. This is a critical issue for this city. Mm-hmm. I don't want anybody to lose track of that while they're getting all involved in the minutia, because at the end of the day, Burns and Mac has offered to do pretty much the same thing that the airlines did, except it's better for the city this way. It's a local company. All the business and all the deals will be made locally. All the people working will be local. All of the money will be here generated local. 18,000 local jobs to mm-hmm. build an airport that does two things. Number one, it is much more efficient, will collect much more revenue, and allow the airlines to expand. And people say, well, they can't guarantee new flights. Well, that's true. But if you're expanding, you're not just going to get bigger, you're going to do more. Mm-hmm. And there are certainly that, and they will bring transfers in here like they do at other airports, which means any plane that flies in from someplace else to transfer is going someplace. That's a direct flight for us. Number two, it will be an airport that meets our needs going forward for the next 40 years. This airport has served us well for the last 40. But you know what? Things changed. Remember what downtown Kansas City was like in 1972? Remember what everything was like in Kansas City in 1972? Remember what the housing was like in downtown Kansas City in 72 and elsewhere? Remember a lot of things about 1972. It's glorious. It's nice. But the Royals were losing. All sorts of things were going on. This is a new day, and we're not building cities for the last 40 years. We're building cities for the next 40 years. And this is an integral business, economic development, travelers' asset that needs to be redone.
You know, you're making a compelling case for this Burns and Mac proposal here. But, Mayor, if you had a vote of the residents of Kansas City today, your city just did a poll of in the last couple of years, and the results weren't that encouraging for going ahead and replacing the three horseshoes. What about that aspect of this whole issue? People arguably don't want it.
Well, there's some people who don't want it, but there's some people who don't want anything.
Well, that's right.
You know, I mean,
but a majority might say, uh-uh.
Well, I think that that's changing, and I think it's changing right before our eyes.
Well, you're making it. You're making them change, yeah.
Well, you know what? It's my job to lead. It's not my job to sit around and wring my hands and say, oh, gee, you know, we can't do anything with this. I'm supposed to be leading the city, and in process of doing that, sometimes you have to tell things to people that make them initially uncomfortable. But some of the best things that have been uncomfortable have turned out to be the best. Let me take you back to before 1972, when there was talk about building MCI. What was the argument? Oh, we can't do that. It's so convenient where it is right now downtown. Why would we ever want to do that? Why don't we KCI spend the money?
KCI you're talking about.
KCI, it's actually MCI, but
well,
yeah, we call it
right,
KCI.
Right.
All right, same thing. So now that we built the airport that everybody thought was so inconvenient, and they love it because of its convenience, why would we do anything differently? Change occurs. One thing that we do know, the airlines will not expand their practices and operations in the current configuration. Mm-hmm. It will not happen. And if they choose to expand elsewhere, that's not going to be good for us. And number two, this airport is not necessarily going to last for the next 40 years without hundreds of millions of dollars of patchwork, and then we're going to wind up in the same place that we are now.
Mm-hmm. Have the airlines signed off on the Burns and Mac idea? Where is that process?
The airlines met on the 12th, which was the day after we were outed in the Star.
Right.
And the airlines
it's called
met.
Breaking news, Mayor.
It was called a lot of things, but we'll take your word for it, okay? You can call it breaking
news.
Yeah,
other words for it.
There's other words for it.
Mm-hmm.
But the airlines met, and they are fine with this. They want to see the rest of the details, just like we all do. But they like this idea because, really, it works to their advantage as well.
Do we know what Burns and Mac's rate of return would be? There's been 6% kicked around, you know, at 1.3%. What is it?
It's probably going to be between 3 and 6%. But here's the thing. It's going to probably be around the 3% because, don't forget, they're on the hook for overruns as well.
Mm-hmm.
All right? So if they're getting—
Why would they do it for 3% money?
because they need to do it. They have 33,000 flights out of here a year. It's cheaper for them to do it for 3% money than to continue to build satellite offices in other places that they can't easily get to by flying out of here. Number two.
Just because it's more convenient from Burns. So that's why they've taken this
it's
on?
It's more convenient for Burns and Mac. It's more convenient for business generally. And business really does radiate. Number two, it's their business. This is their calling card. This could be a showplace that they can show off to others. Number three, Burns and Mac has done so much in this community that people don't know about. It's not like they've been sitting in the corner. Whenever there's something that needs to be done, they contribute. Whenever there's people that need to be done, they help. Whenever we talk about building a minority workforce, like with overflow control, they ran a college for that for a few years to get that done. They are integral, valuable parts of this community, just like Dunn is, just like KCP&L is, just like DST is. All of these companies love this city, and they do things for this city and for the good of the overall city. And that's one of the major motivating factors here.
Mayor Sly James is my guest. We're talking about KCI. Dan from Lee's Summit. Dan, welcome to the show.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You bet.
Hey, I'm retired, but I was a lifetime financial analyst for the federal government, and I work with return on investment and payback periods and net present values. And to me, it just seems like if Burns and McDonald really thinks that they're going to get a 3-6% return on investment, and they're providing the data to support that over a service lock cash flow of what, 30-35 years, the mayor said.
That's right.
That's a very good return on investment. Between 3-6, but return on investments from, you know, 35-40 year cash flows can be greatly affected on rates of return, interest rates charged by funding institutions, on the rates of on the revenue that they project that they're going to get. And it, in my estimation, if Burns and McDonald is providing this information, my experience is that whoever provides information into a cash flow for return on investment analysis or financial analysis, they can tweak those numbers. And I use tweak very guardedly. But those are the numbers that I would look at to say, you know, if they think they can make 3-6%, then they're probably going to make more than that.
Okay.
And if they're going to make more than that, why doesn't the city do it? And why don't the city just take the profits from this operation and build this? I think I agree with the single terminal because the airlines want it to expand. But why don't we make money on that from the city?
What about that, Mayor?
Because it's an airport operation. Airport is a closed loop. City is not involved in that. We don't pay for it. We don't take money out except for the taxes on goods
sold. But if there's money to be made here, though.
It's still a closed loop. It's federal. It is not city. It's a closed loop.
So you couldn't use that money to build streets and
absolutely
sewers?
Absolutely not.
Yeah.
If it's airport money, it stays in the airport, period. End of story.
You know, Kansas Cityans have asked me this, Mayor. Will they get a chance to review the design of any terminal proposal
Absolutely.
That Burns and Mac comes up with or anybody else?
Not only will they get a chance to review it, they'll have a chance to have input into it.
Okay.
Here's the thing. Nothing has changed except substitute Burns and Mac for the airlines. That's it. Now, you can argue with whether or not you like the Burns and Mac deal, but the entire schematic of what we were doing remains the same. The airlines, when the airlines were going to be the ones doing it, there was still going to be opportunity for the city and people to have input into the design and those factors. They were still going to be consulted. They were still going to vote. The only thing that's changed is the financing issue.
What's the next step here? What happens next before you go?
The council has hired independent counsel. They will review the documents and make sure that the city's interests are protected. They will then be asked to approve this on June 15th, the MOU going forward. If they do that on June 15th, then Burns and Mac will start working on pulling together contractors on bids to see that they can make a maximum final number. If they can make a maximum final number that they can afford, then we go forward. If they can make a final number that they can't afford, then we grind to a halt. We go back to the airlines and beg them to come back up with the $964 million. Those are our two options. If those fail, then we're out.
Okay. We're going to leave our conversation there. That's Kansas City Mayor Sly James. Mayor, always appreciate you coming in.
Thanks.
Thanks very
Good
much.
See you.
KCUR contributor Bill Brownlee is back with this week's Local Listen. And Bill, how are you?
I'm well, thank you.
You want to talk about Olita Adams and why not? One of our long-standing jazz mainstays in this town.
She's one of Kansas City and the world's greatest voices, and she is going to be closing down the festival this weekend in the Jazz District.
Which is going to be a big deal. Three-day festival. We haven't had one here in town for a few years. This is a new day for jazz, perhaps, in Kansas City.
It is, and I'm really getting excited about this. It's a terrific lineup with wonderful, locally based and international talent.
We had John Schofield on the show yesterday. Chick Corea is going to be here, Bobby Watts and everybody else. Let's listen to Olita Adams here. This is Do I Move You from her new album, Third Set.
Do I move you? Are you willing? Do I groove you? Is it thrilling? Do I soothe you? Tell the truth now.
My goodness, she's making me nervous there, Bill.
that's pretty
good stuff.
It is. This is an old Nina Simone song that she's revived, and it's instead of sounding ominous, it's sultry. I like it.
You know, she's been around Kansas City for quite a while, but it's been a while since she released some new music, right?
Right. Third Set is her first new album in several years, and the idea implied by the title is this showcases Olita and her band in an informal atmosphere that reflects sort of an end of the night vibe.
I understand that she had a little run-in with Tears for Fears back in the day. What's that about?
Yeah, the story goes that she was working in an area lounge performing, and the British band Tears for Fears were staying in the hotel. They went up for a drink, a nightcap after their show, saw her perform, and saw something in her, made her a part of their entourage, recorded with her. She had a hit with the band as a duet, Woman in Chains, and then went on to have a substantial solo career, including the big 1991 hit, Get Here.
That was a big hit, right?
Huge ballad, a slow dance song for the end of the night.
That's Olita Adams. She'll be performing at this weekend's Kansas City Jazz and Heritage Festival. She's closing out the festival, Bill just said. Bill, thanks for coming in and enlightening us on the great Olita Adams. Appreciate it.
It's my pleasure.
Tomorrow on the show, why Americans are divided on issues like gender identity and race, and we speak with the president of Actors Equity, who's coming to town with a Broadway musical, Fun Home. You can follow us on Twitter. We're at KCUR Up to Date, and you can follow me at Steve Kraske. Our program is produced by Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Coy Duggar, and Marlia Campbell. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.